Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel ashamed of. My name is Caroline Donoghue and I'm the lone guest at a monkey's funeral. Joining me is drag performer and someone who is always ready for their close-up, Joe Black.
And now, Sidereal, I'm ready for my close-up.
Today we're doing Sunset Boulevard by the director Billy Wilder, starring Gloria Swanson and William Holden. And Joe, this was your pick, and I want to know what made you pick it.
Do you know, I think it's got that right balance of... It's obviously a pastiche of, you know, the Hollywood studio system and all of that. And I just love that whole era, but it's kind of the aftermath of it that I find more fascinating. And it's camp... but it's still an epic. Do you know what I mean? It knows that it's camp. It knows that it's ridiculous, but it's still like, it's hard to explain, but it's very much still a legitimately incredible film, but while being completely absurd.
That's such a wonderful point, because if you think about like the cornerstones of camp cinema, and I'm thinking like Mommy Dearest or like John Waters stuff, there's kind of an accepted reality that we love these things even though they're bad. But this has just as huge and mad and absurd a central camp lady performance, and yet it's so exquisitely made and so thoughtfully made in every way.
Yeah, it's a genuine, it's not even, because a lot of these things, they have like an irony to them. You kind of go, oh, it's so good, but with a wink. But this absolutely does not have a wink to it. It just revels in its own ability to be both ludicrous and a wonderfully made classic film.
I'd love to know when you first came across it, because when I look at your drag, it's one of the first things I think about, is why I was so drawn to you the minute I saw you on TV. I was like, oh, there's Norma Desmond.
Well, that's very much a conscious choice on my part. But the how I discovered it, so I used to do a show in, we used to fly to Rome with a performer called La Postra, who now lives in Berlin. And the thing about these hotels we'd be in Rome is they would always have balconies. Postra, who was a big fan of kind of camp classic cinema, would go onto the balcony and wrap a scarf around their head and put on sunglasses and lean over the balcony and go, "You there, why are you so late?" And I had no idea what they were talking about. And they introduced me to so many wonderful things. They introduced me to Hedwig and the Angry Inch as well. And Short Bus and John Cameron Mitchell stuff and Sunset Boulevard and I think Mummy Dearest was of my own volition finding that. But I think I would have been maybe 20, 21. At this point, and they kept
So very much a formative time for your career, I would think, for like discovering who you were as
absolutely,
a performer.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that now I love it so much, and it's become such a part of the fibre of my inspiration that I forget there was ever a time that I didn't know what it was. Yeah, it was just from literally from seeing them quote it, and then they sent me a list. And this is of the time of DVDs, so I made my way down to Amazon to HMV, and they'd give me a big list of things, and I bought all of the DVDs of all these things, and Sunset Boulevard was one of them. And I sort of desperately fell in love with it. And it just, I can't think of a time when I haven't known it now. And when I went into Drag Race, I really wanted to reference it so that my hope was with these things. I love the idea of me having said something which makes other people look it up. Oh, no, it's such a shame. On my second elimination on Drag Race. So the first time I kind of panicked and I got to the end of the runway and I went, Mr. Charles, I'm ready for my close-up, and left. But the second time, I was just before it happened, I was like, do it, Joe, do it. And I left. And as I was about to leave the stage, I turned and I said, cut the cameras. I can't go on with the scene. I'm too happy. And you could see, when I said cut the cameras, RuPaul and Michelle Visage, they kind of went, what are you doing? Like, almost, you could see it in their faces. And then as soon as I said, I can't go on with the scene, I'm too happy, you could see them both light up because they were like, oh, he's going to do it. He's going to do it. And then I went into the full, I just want to say how happy I am to be back in the studio making another picture. And I did the full speech. And then I like walked back forward and I stared one of the cameras right into it. And I went, just us, the cameras, and all of you wonderful people out there in the dark. Then I turned, I said, and I've said it before and I'll say it again. Mr. Charles, I'm ready for my close-up. But they cut out the entire exit speech.
That is fabulous. What did they cut it down to? I don't even remember.
Straight back down to, and I've said it before and I'll say it again, Mr. Charles, I'm ready for my close-up. And
oh, that's so disappointing.
I know.
Oh, God, I'm so sad that we missed that performance, but we're getting it right now. It really is an honour and a pleasure to have this.
It was, yeah, that was like, when I knew that episode was coming up, I was like, God, I hope they've kept in the whole speech. But no, alas, not.
It's so interesting that you bring all that up because, you know, this is very much an appreciation podcast because we both fucking love this movie. It's been one of my favourite movies since I was about 14. And I just remember, you know, I'm a novelist, and the moment I saw that monkey funeral, I had this sort of bell ringing moment in my head going like, oh my God, you can write about anything.
Yeah.
you can really put anything up there and they'll make it. And it was such an inspirational moment for me as a writer. But then seeing you reference it on UK Drag Race, and what was so kind of ironic about the whole thing is that, you know, I love that show and I love that franchise, but I think even the biggest fans of it would say they are quite a youth obsessed mm-hmm. show. Like they often praise these kind of vintage references in the context of maybe Snatch Game. But when someone is sort of referencing an older character or plays an older character, they get frustrated with it very quickly.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah. It was so ironic that you were playing this Norma Desmond character and they were doing the same thing to you that they did to Norma Desmond, which was they kind of dismissed it as being kind of hokey or an old style. I'm not saying they did that, but do you know what I mean? It felt like very fitting that someone playing Norma Desmond would receive that sort of treatment on the show.
Very, very full circle moment. It was funny because my Snatch Game that I'd brought was Tallulah Bankhead.
Oh, wow.
Was my, so again, it was like that. I mean, again, that could have been something that they would have been like, oh my God, someone's finally done Tallulah Bankhead. Or they could have done the, no one's going to know who Tallulah Bankhead is thing. You know what I mean? But I was like, I went in there and I was like, right, I'm getting out the classic references. I'm going to do this. And if it means just a couple of people Google who they are and it makes them very happy, then I'm very happy.
Oh, well, hopefully if, you know, a couple more people Google it and go watch it because of this podcast today, we'll be all the happier. I'm going to do a quick plot summary for anybody who hasn't seen it. Okay, so when struggling screenwriter Joe Gillis parks his car in a mansion on Sunset Boulevard, he thinks it's abandoned. Little does he know that it's the home of Norma Desmond, one of the great stars of the silent era. When Joe offers to edit her screenplay, Salome, he thinks he's found a cushy deal, but soon finds that Norma is the one taking advantage of him. Joe becomes a kept man and finds himself increasingly smothered by Norma's attention. As her comeback falters, Norma loses her grip on reality and kills Joe in a jealous rage. And that's really not a spoiler because the movie famously opens with Joe's death. He's floating in a swimming pool.
Yeah, and also that's a very, very parodied opening, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think there's a book I've got the Audible one of it about the making of Sunset Boulevard. And I think originally it started in the morgue with the corpse sort of sitting up and talking. And then they did sort of screen tests of it and people found it too absurd. So they changed it and did the swimming pool. But the thing was the swimming pool thing has become such an iconic opening, you know, everything from like The Simpsons and Family Guy and American, all of those like cartoons that, you know, send up famous scenes in films, no matter how obscure, they've all done a detective or noir episode that begins with someone in a pool.
I think there's one in Family Guy where someone's like frozen in a pool of Jello, which is quite fun. And it's what makes this movie a noir, isn't it? The fact that we know there's going to be a death from the opening. Like I think about Double Indemnity, which is another Billy Wilder film from the 30s, which opens with the guy who's been shot and he's kind of giving his confession while he slowly bleeds out.
Is Double Indemnity? Double Indemnity is it Penelope? Is it Stenwick?
Barbara Stanwyck, yeah.
Barbara, what does... Oh, it's because I know a drag queen called Penelope Stanwyck. Which is basically...
Often confused.
So, yeah. Is it... That's the one with the... When she's in the supermarket and she's got the sunglasses on peering over the shelf, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, and the one where she has the ankle bracelet as well. It's like the only film where you'll see an ankle bracelet be a plot point. It's very erotic. But the thing about the pool scene and all that sort of stuff is that like you have that opening pool scene of like, okay, we know this guy is dead. And then we kind of have 15 minutes of just like gumph, of just kind of like us is kind of following around Joe Gillis and getting this whole notion that he's kind of this failed screenwriter, and it takes us quite a while to get to Norma Desmond. And whenever I rewatch this movie, I kind of tend to mentally fast forward all the Joe Gillis opener. Do you?
Yeah, no, well, yeah, every time. But I think it's the kind of the drawing out of it, I think, makes it more satisfying when she gets there, because it kind of feels like a different film where it's like not particularly absurd and then the first time you see her is a monkey funeral.
Yes.
So I mean, it goes from like sort of, you know, 2 to 100 in 15 minutes, just within maybe a 2 minute period, it just amps up to something else entirely.
So explain to our listeners the monkey funeral in all its glory. It's just so perfect.
Well, so Joe is escaping some debt collectors that would like to take his car, and he's driving up Sunset Boulevard, and he pulls into what he believes to be an abandoned old Spanish mansion, is what they're called, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And he believes it to be abandoned. He's just walking around the grounds because, you know, he's out of the way of the debt people. And then suddenly this shadowy figure appears on a balcony and says, "You there! Why are you so late?" And then a butler, you know, welcomes him into the house, and he's trying to explain that, you know, he's just pulled up here, like he doesn't know what's going on, and he's sort of forced upstairs, to which he finds this leopard print turban, robe wearing round sunglasses woman, with a sheet over a figure who believes him to be the Undertaker. And it soon becomes clear that it is her beloved pet monkey that she is talking about the funeral arrangements of. And you think it's like, oh goodness, it's a child, you know, and then it's a monkey.
it's simply a monkey. And it's just the sort of the poetic kind of undertones of the whole thing is when the high camp really starts. Because, you know, the fact that we know Joe is dead and he's already being mistaken for the Undertaker just shrouds his entire character in doom, right? There's just no hope and we're like not given any reason to hope for him. But also the fact that he's going to be the new monkey, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And also in that book that I have the audio for, they were trying to like really build up the relationship between Norma and the monkey. And Billy, not Billy Wilder. Yeah, Billy Wilder. Gloria Swanson, who played Norma Desmond, was quite a conservative woman. Mm-hmm. Or at least very kind of prudish.
Yeah.
And he was trying to explain the relationship to the monkey with her, and she'd sort of go along with it. And then I think he said something to her like, you know, and you have fucked the monkey. And then she was furious with Billy Wilder for suggesting that Norma Desmond had fucked the monkey. The whole thing is just so ridiculous. And do you know the other options they had for playing Norma Desmond?
I know they went for Pola Negri. They kind of went for a couple of people who were stars of the silent screen, right?
Yeah, I think they went for Pola Negri. I think they went for Greta Garbo, of course.
Yes.
And they also went for Mae West. But the problem with Mae West is because they, you know, in all the ridiculousness of the film, I think Mae West is the wrong kind of ridiculous.
Yes, I totally agree. It would have been a completely different movie if it was Mae West, you know?
I mean, Mae West can only do Mae West. Whereas Gloria Swanson, like, on reflection, you think no one else could have played that part the same. No one.
And I think it's so crucial that it's Gloria Swanson as well, because the thing is that Greta Garbo had a successful career in sound, and Mae West, like her cadence and her the way her voice sounds is very well known to to people still, right? But the thing about Gloria Swanson is that they needed somebody who was legitimately huge, but who most people did not have a context for what she actually sounded like. And it completely underlines the entire sort of tragedy of the downfall of silent film, which is this whole thing of, and there's really very few case studies of entertainment like this, where something that dominated and had an entire industry and had no sort of historical precedent before or since, that was the entire way of making movies and had its own style of acting, its own style of production, everything. The fact that that could just vanish overnight, never to be revisited again, and to only really be referred to as like a primitive form of cinema, that's the whole sort of tragedy of it, right? And that's why you need someone like Gloria Swanson, who's there, and her acting style is still informed by that silent film acting, right? It's these long, big gestures and these big eyes, and every movement, even when she's behaving quite casually or when she's having a moment to herself, she's still acting like she's in a silent film. And that's what makes, it's almost like there's two movies at work here. It's the silent movie that is her life still going on, and the contemporary 1950 movie. You know, it's what makes it so striking when she appears on screen.
Yeah, I mean, you were saying, like, every single movement from her. It's kind of silent movie acting. It's not even quite stage acting, is it? It's its own thing. Like, it's, yeah. You know, the you know, because I think sometimes you can kind of, there's a disjoint between people that do film and people that do stage. And silent movie is neither of those things. I mean, it's maybe closer to stage acting because everything's got to be so big, but it's got to be so big because there are no words, not just to fill a space. I'd love to, I mean, not that anyone will ever get the chance to really hammer and home and learn silent movie acting, because you have no need for it anymore. You know, the time it would take to do it, how you can't, that doesn't translate to the stage and it doesn't translate to sound film, but it's just, there's a real charm and a beauty to just the faces, the movements, the reactions, the eyes, the hands.
Totally. And, and you say that you'd love to learn it, but also the tragedy is there's no one left to teach you.
I mean, you know? Betty White's still around, isn't she?
Did she do silent?
No, I don't think she did. I think she was very early television.
Wow, like... I think that's why it's so seductive. And you said at the beginning of this how, like, you love the silent era, but the kind of the mythology and the whole parable around silent film and the whole thing of it being just retired in a matter of years, and the notion that in the 1950s these people were still hanging around, like they were like these haunted, these ghostly figures that just lived in Hollywood and that Billy Wilder would see, and how often, and the thing about silent film as well, I read quite a lot about it, and I think there's a misnomer that people who, the silent film stars, that they couldn't hack talking. Like, that's kind of the mythology this film puts forward, that, oh, they just couldn't talk. They all sounded weird and no one liked the way they spoke. But actually, what was really happening was as talking pictures began, it was also all these studios were beginning to unionize and formalize and become extremely corporate, and cinema stopped becoming this intrepid, dangerous, sort of risky, creative DIY movement where people just kind of made it up as they went along. It became very formal, and that's why you get people like Buster Keaton, who always had his own way of making his own stuff, and he had his own crew. Like, he was basically stripped for parts by the studio system, and then he ended up not owning any of his own work, and he died sort of broke. And now you see him in this movie and he's got this sort of a ravaged face, and his only line is the word pass, you know? Yeah, it gets
having,
me.
Having the actual silent movie stars of your in that scene as well, because it's something that you can also kind of miss.
Like
the first time I watched it, I didn't clock it. I can't even remember if they were introduced, because they're what they call them, the waxworks. Yeah, I don't think they're named, are they? They just call them the waxworks.
Yeah, that's it, exactly.
So it's when you look back and you're like, that's Buster Keaton. Do you know, I find it endlessly fascinating. And what you were saying about the kind of DIY, kind of dangerous approach to silent movie is that a lot of the aesthetics have a real dark vibe. You mean, like, there's very few silent movies that I think I look at and I think everyone looks clean and gorgeous. Everyone just looks a little bit grubby and a little bit off. Do you know what I mean? There's a way of makeup, there's a way of costume that it's very, very magical. Even the sort of old Crawford ones. I forget how vampy Joan Crawford is. Still, it's like that thing with silent movies that everything is so dark. Like, Joan Crawford looks like she's a vamp. But that it's just a silent movie thing, isn't it? That just everything would just had to be harsher. It had to be darker. It had to be more intense.
Yeah, completely. And I think what a lot of people don't know as well is that pre the Hays Code, which was a set of morals and standards that were implemented in American cinema in 1935, there was really no rules about what you could depict on camera. So, like, mm-hmm. it could get incredibly gritty pre that era. And so there's a lot of, like, you know, there's like a lot of flesh. There's a lot of, like, seduction. There's a lot of violence. You know, it's mm-hmm. so much more than people ever really give it credit for. And it's really worth investigating if you have the time to.
And I think they had some problems with the Hays Code in the making of Sunset Boulevard, because of course in cinema it was perfectly fine for an older man to have a younger woman, but they had an older woman with a younger man, which is of course immoral, you know.
And so, yeah, we have this thing, to go back to where we are in the movie. We have the monkey funeral and sort of Joe, they have this big misunderstanding where she's like, get out of here. And Joe sort of goes, okay, I'm off, see you later. And then he goes, hang on, don't I know you? Didn't you used to be in pictures? And then they establish that she is Norma Desmond, the former star. And she tells, and she says the iconic line, I am big, it's the pictures that got small, when he accuses her of having once been big.
Which I just love. That whole speech is just something else. They took the idols and smashed them. The Gilberts, the Fairbanks, the Valentinos. And who do we have now? Some nobody. Then Joe says his line. Right words, words, more words. Oh God, I've got it all messed up. But where you get the... But, and it's the... What's the line? And she says like... And Technicolor to photograph the red swollen tongues.
Yes, that's the most... That when I was watching it back this morning, I was like, what a fucking creepy line.
What? But like, that's dark, isn't it? And Technicolor to photograph the red swollen tongues. It's so grotesque.
It really... It's so mad. It's like... It's so weird. Like, the... Because you think like, oh, here's just a lady who sort of lives in a delusion, and but it's so much more layered than that. It's so gothic and strange, and every part of it is just loaded with like mayhem and the macabre. Yeah,
it's spiteful. It's venomous. It's like there's like a vendetta. It's not. She's not just going, oh, it's nothing. You know what I mean? There's pure vitriol. About talking.
It's, yeah, and we just from that moment we know this movie belongs to her, and she moves him in. She's basically he reveals that he's a screenwriter, and it's very interesting the way he does it, because he could just leave. He could just be like, okay, have a nice life, lady. But he's like, there's that thing that happens when you're in the creative arts and somebody else is also, and you kind of want them to know, oh, you know, we're kind of peers, you and I. And that's kind of his undoing, because at that moment she's like, oh, I'm writing a screenplay for my comeback. You're a writer. You're going to help me write it. And so she moves him into this little leaking guest cottage just above the tennis courts, and he's escorted there by her butler Max. And what can you tell us about Max?
A very kind of Lurch-esque figure.
Yes, very Lurch.
Very Lurch. He's very ominous. And also what's more ominous is that the guest room is already set up.
Oh, yeah.
The room is already set up. And then when he's like, oh, how did you know I was staying? He was just... Basically, it's a case of like, he knows all. You know what I mean? This kind of shadowy, always watching figure, Max. Because the guy that played him was a director, right?
Yeah, it was Eric von Stroheim.
So it's the Weimar kind of era people.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a famous thing where him and Gloria Swanson, who plays Norma Desmond, worked together on a movie they never finished called Queen Kelly. That apparently he was such an artiste, he could just never... He blew the budget on the first third and they had to shut down production. But frames of it still survive, and they end up watching it in the film itself, in Sunset Boulevard. Joe and Norma watch it together. Which is such a fun, just kind of art and life and art moment. It's like there really is no greater example of a movie when art imitates life more than Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, it's. I mean, even the pictures she has of Norma Desmond are all the old Gloria Swanson headshots.
Yeah, and it's like you have to think, like, because Gloria Swanson herself said, you know, Billy Wilder didn't really give her any direction. He was just like, it's you, just do you, or do your work yourself, dwell on your own life. And I think she found it quite difficult having to deal with her own history. And she talks about filming that scene with Buster Keaton and the other silent stars, because she at least has this sort of whole narrative and whole character written for her. But those guys were just wheeled in to be referred to by the narrative as washed up, which must have been like psychologically just very fucking difficult.
Oh yeah. But like, and then I think in this book that I have about Sunset is the scene where, I mean, we're jumping forward a little bit, but just talking about kind of her relationship with other silent stars is, I think she went to go visit Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, really?
Doing something while... Because I don't think his career wasn't doing well by the 50s, right? He was...
Yeah, he'd been, like, excommunicated by the American government, hadn't he?
Yeah, but I think he was doing... I think it was Charlie Chaplin that she went to go visit him working in during the whole kind of Sunset Boulevard process. I can't... Maybe it wasn't during... But it's very much the kind of later scene when she visits the studio. But in terms of, like, these people and this whole film is... What it's kind of, I mean, it's criticizing the Hollywood system, yeah. But this whole thing about all silent things being washed up, and she's just, that's still kind of her life. That's her group. Those are her, genuinely her friends, her colleagues. You know, she, you know, Gloria Swanson hadn't particularly moved on by this point. You know, yeah, she would have had the same group of friends.
It's brutal, isn't it? Like, it's weird because I feel like even though she is this outsized, camp, crazy character, I feel like the movie is on her side for the most part. The movie sympathizes with what she's been through. But still, to make her and those actors play that out, there is a kind of a streak of cruelty. There's kind of a streak of mockery as well. It's kind of, it's interesting how it balances.
Yeah, because I think Hollywood was quite angry in general about this film, because I think it was the first time that anyone had, like, a Hollywood film had criticized Hollywood. Because, you know, it's sold as the dream, the best, you know, the pinnacle. And this was the first film that went, it chews you up and spits you out.
And, like, people were genuinely very mad about it, right? Like,
yeah. So Louis Mayer, I think, came to one of the screenings and he told Billy Wilder that he was basically a disgrace for doing this. And then Billy Wilder told him to fuck off.
Nice.
Like, publicly in front of all of his friends, he said, go fuck yourself.
Yeah, I think I remember reading this story. It's like Louis B. Mayer said, like, you've basically shat your own bed by criticizing the system that's nurtured you. And he's got like, well, fuck off. Which, yeah, I respect.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So tell me what you think about with the whole Joe Gillis, Norma Desmond kind of pseudo romance possession story. Tell me about how all that gets started.
It's, well, you know, he's just sort of writing and then she starts, you know, looking after him, doesn't she? She's like making sure that he has everything he needs. She's the elements of control start with the script. And then just slowly, 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 it starts going on to him.
It all sort of galvanizes this kind of creeping dread, and, like, you know, the his clothes get nicer, and Joe, as we know, is broke, and she buys him things and brings him to the tailors and all that. And I don't think they've had sex yet or had any kind of romantic leanings, but then it all kind of comes to this moment where she has a Christmas party.
Oh, it's New Year's Eve.
Oh, it's New Year's Eve. Go on.
It's New Year's Eve, yes. And she, you know, she talks to me, you know, she's got a band. And as far as Joe is concerned, there will be many, many people there. And then he comes down in his tux that she has provided for him. And it's just them two. Oh. She's just had the floors changed, hasn't she? She says something like, Valentino, there was some reference about Valentino and Dan. Valentino danced on these floors, or something like that. But as the band are playing, and it's just them two with Max, and it's all very strange. And the band just playing, and it's all very, very strange. And, you know, they have their argument, and off he goes to another New Year's Eve party, where you know, he's flirting with young lady, and he, you know, and then gets the call saying that she's done something very, very silly. And then he rushes back. And I think that's probably one of the darkest moments in the film, really, because I can never, it isn't quite explained whether she actually did. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's not like explicitly shown whether she's faking it or not. So I always think about that, whether she's actually done it. And it's you can see the manipulation in her face when she knows that it's worked.
And this thing of like, we have this kind of foreshadowing because there's no locks on the doors. And Max says, you know, Madame is prone to fits of melancholy. And we're given that to believe that she's had sort of suicide attempts before or self-harm or whatever. And then you're right. Joe comes back from this New Year's Eve party that his young, vibrant sort of upstart. Everyone's kind of in the film business, and like the sort of juxtaposition of that party, which is so wild and seems really fun, with the quote unquote party at Norma's house is so, you know, it's such a clash. And then when he gets back there and we just see her on her bed with the bandages on her arms and the doctor leaving. But you're right, there's like, because Max is, his whole MO in life is to help her create these fantasies for herself. There's really no guarantee as to whether it actually happened.
Mm-hmm. But also one of the lovely little touches about that scene is that the band is still playing.
Yeah. Ugh.
Yeah, and they play Old Lang Syne starts.
Yes.
During that scene.
And he just takes her on the bed and kisses her.
Yep. And then have you ever seen it live? The stage show?
I have actually seen the stage show with Glenn Close in the title role.
Me too. I saw that one. And there's that moment is a real kind of like, almost like they embrace, and you could kind of, you get this feeling of her looking at the audience like, my plan worked.
It really is that sort of spider catching something in the web, just wrapping it in silk, really, and just to devour and suck the blood of. It's a real vampire movie.
Oh yeah. She's a vampire. That, you know, I'd never thought about it like that, but you're right. No, that is a vampire.
And it's interesting because, like, the longer Joe spends in her lair, in her like old gothic mansion with the old movies and the whistling organ and the big fire, the more he spends in that world, the less youthful he becomes. And every time he bumps into his old friends throughout the movie, he seems more and more removed from them. It's almost like a generation has grown between them just by him hanging out with Norma.
Mm-hmm. Or for the vamp thing is that she's maybe sucking his life force. She's consuming him.
And then it's like, but it's this sort of thing because he then starts up this thing with Betty, who's this 22-year-old aspiring screenwriter. And then she's kind of giving him the get up and go to get on with his career. So it's actually the sort of, he's his own kind of vampire. Like, Norma is a mental character, but Joe is not innocent, you know?
Oh, yeah. And he, but it's kind of that, I mean, it's strange watching this film because obviously he's one of the leads. But do you find that you just do not care about him?
Not at all, no.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, he is, for me, he's purely there to allow Norma Desmond to exist.
Yes.
Like, I'm never once looking at him if he's in a scene with her. I'm like, in my head, I could just see her. I can just see her. I can see the outfits. I can see. Actually, there was an interesting, that was a thing about one of the outfits. So, do you know when she goes to the studio and she has the peacock feather?
Yes.
In her hat. And I can't remember the exact reason, so I don't want to misquote, but I will sort of vaguely from like my recollection. The peacock was a reference to a costume that was in a Cecil B. DeMille film that Norma, I mean, that Gloria Swanson wore. And I think the peacock was a thing of contention. There was a problem with this peacock costume, which is why they put the peacock feather in her hair.
Oh.
With, I think it was a problem with Edith Head, who did all the costumes for Sunset. It was her being spiteful to Cecil B. DeMille in the design, because she'd had an issue with him, something to do with like a peacock cape or some big costume, that there'd been some argument and disagreement with Cecil B. DeMille and Edith Head. And yeah, that's why she put the peacock feather in her hat.
That's so great.
For the Cecil B. DeMille scene, yeah. I can't remember, but it was definitely a spite reason.
Everything in this film happened for a spite reason.
Oh, yeah. And then also having Edith Head do the costumes was just, you know, who else could have done it? You know, she was genuinely dressing these people.
Like, such a living legend. Like, it's so amazing to me now when you watch any kind of movie pre-1965 and it's always costumes by Mrs. Edith Head, always, you know. It's incredible how much power that woman had, and you can really see it. Like, the way that her clothes are just so impeccably glamorous while also being a little bit out of date is just so iconic.
And the reason she wore the, for listeners who are unfamiliar with Edith Head, is Edna Mode in The Incredibles is based on her.
Of course, yeah.
And obviously Edna Mode wears the big glasses. So Edith Head always wore dark glasses, and people thought it was like a fashion statement. But it became her kind of look, because she had to wear, she wore these blue, dark blue tinted glasses, because when she was designing, she could see how the colours would translate into black and white.
Oh, wow. That's so cool.
So that's why she wore the glasses. It's because everything would look different. Yep. As soon as it was in black and white, things just, they don't look the same. I mean, some sort of silent movie makeup, if you had seen it in colour, it would have looked insane. I mean, people having like green stripes on their noses and, you know, literally pure black lips because they look like, or dark blue lips because it reads as red on black and white film. And it's just, people's faces were like all bizarre colours because that's just how it translated to camera.
It's so fabulous, isn't it? And to have something like have that black and white palette, and yet for things to still look so lush and glamorous, and to have that implication of color and movement is so well done. Like, it's the reason why Edith Head is Edith Head, you know.
I mean, that's the thing is you know, you can have an amazing. Could you imagine a contemporary designer designing for black and white? You know, no matter how good someone is, it's his own skill. Because, you know, some colours all look the same, and then suddenly you put that in front of the camera, and what was once a plush, lovely thing may not translate the same. So not only was she designing these amazing looks, but it had to be different from the actual eye to what it looked like on camera. Like, it was an entirely different translation of the whole piece. So to have that element and still manage to keep, like you said, that kind of plushness, that opulence. Yeah, incredible. Yeah.
I want to talk more about that studio visit, because for me, it's like one of the real centerpieces of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have this, I'm not sure exactly how much time the movie take place over. I'm going to say like 6 months, but we have this whole montage where Joe kind of accepts that he's now Norma Desmond's plaything, and he, you know, he doesn't seem unhappy. He goes, uses the pool. He's having a great life. He's, you know, in the lap of luxury. And he kind of accepts that this movie she's always banging on about isn't going to happen. And then she starts getting calls from the Paramount lot saying that they want her to come in and they want to talk to her and all this. And if you're watching this movie for the first time, you're weirdly delighted, because you're like, maybe there is something to her script. Maybe there is something to her comeback. And then she gets herself all dolled up. She goes down in her ancient old car with Max and Joe, and they go down to the set, and she sees Cecil B. DeMille, who she assumes wants to talk to her, and they were these old peers. And there's this moment where Cecil B. DeMille, his first AD, comes up to him and says, you know, oh, Norma Desmond's on the set, she must be a million years old. And then Cecil sort of looks at him and says, well, I hate to think where that puts me. And it's really the most direct way the movie confronts sort of misogyny in Hollywood, and this whole thing of like, these men stay the same and only the women change, you know, like these stars, they're built and they're broken. And almost everybody who used to work with Norma Desmond still has a job. But her, this person who was the focal point of this global campaign for fame and stardom in cinema, she's the only thing that was actually completely replaceable.
Yeah, it, you're right. It's all the men working there, you know, Hawkeye. It's
hello, Hawkeye.
Hawkeye. Hello. Let's put a light on you, Miss Desmond. It's but then of course for those like you said, for those of people watching it for the first time, there is that glimmer of hope. But the reality is even sadder than you can possibly imagine. No, they do not want her. They want her car because it's so dated. It's so old. They need it for a period piece.
Yeah, they just want to rent out this relic, and the relic isn't even her.
Yep. And
it's so tragic.
And she's there looking like an absolute bird of paradise. You know, and they kind of usher her away and go, oh, look after yourself, I've got to do my job now. And then they basically, as they leave, go, how sad.
Oh.
Don't they?
It really is just so heartbreaking. It really, it's like, it's funny because it's just completely vain and self-obsessed character who's been living in this delusion for years, and who the men in her life are helping her to maintain the delusion. But you, as the audience member, also at this point want to help her maintain the delusion. You don't want her to feel bad.
No, and she's technically the villain, but she's the villain that you're cheering on.
Yeah, and I think anybody who's, you know, had a full career in the arts or in anything creative or whatever, you have to be everyone in this film eventually. Like, everyone starts off as Betty, just wanting to write their thing and get their leg up. And then I feel like I'm now Joe, just like mildly cynical and sort of doubts anything that will ever really happen. And then eventually you end up as Norma. Like, that's why she's so sympathetic, is that everybody who's had their dreams come true also has to put up with the idea of being someone totally faded and forgotten.
I mean, I've done reality TV and I fully prepared myself for that Norma Desmond life. I'll be walking into the gay bars with, you know, my turban and my sunglasses on, and someone will go, oh, it's Joe Black. And I'll go, Hawkeye, hello.
To the bar.
As I make my way to the flashing LED stage where the drag queens sing, I don't know why I'm frightened.
Just putting that one spotlight on you while everyone gathers around in clusters and talks to you about H&M dresses.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's it. That is exactly it.
Oh God!
And you know they're making the film, the musical film, right?
The musical of your H&M dress?
No, of Sunset Boulevard.
Well, they're filming the musical.
The film, yeah.
Oh my God! Okay, so I gotta be honest with you. I don't love the musical. What are your thoughts on it?
I enjoy it. I don't necessarily like it for all of the songs. I like it for the story and I like it for the set. But we do have Glenn Close playing Norma Desmond in the film.
Oh my God.
So, I mean, I think it's going to be, it's going to be amazing seeing that all in full Technicolor to photograph the red swollen tongues. And I think Glenn Close is so good as Norma Desmond.
She really is the perfect person for that role, isn't she?
Yeah. And then this book that I keep referring to that I've got the order of is they talk about how Faye Dunaway was going to play Norma after Glenn. And basically, like, no one can live up to Glenn Close doing it, no matter how good someone is. Because though Glenn isn't the strongest singer, I mean, the Faye Dunaway one didn't happen. I think they cancelled it before because they just sold no tickets. She pulled out and there was a big lawsuit with her and Andrew Lloyd Webber and all of that. But Glenn Close is kind of lauded as the best Norma Desmond because she's not the greatest singer, but she embodies the character the most. Everyone else is too grand, but not in the right way. They don't have that kind of vulnerable. I mean, Patti LuPone has played her, but Patti LuPone is too big and too competent. There needs to be, still with the power, a slight incompetence to Norma because she's not anything anymore. You know what I mean? She still needs to be that faded. I mean, Glenn Close is anything but a faded star. But Patti LuPone holds herself too big and too seriously, and her singing's too good, but she's not as good of an actor.
Yes, and also there's something about Patti LuPone is not an underdog. Like, she's someone who has been, her star has never faded for however long she's been on the stage. She's always been, like, that bitch. But there's something about Glenn Close, even though she's this huge movie star, there's always been this sort of narrative around her kind of not getting the awards that she should and her not getting the roles that she should. And people who love Glenn Close really do have this sort of, like, Glenn Close was robbed queen narrative around Glenn Close. Yeah. And that it makes her so kind of, I don't know, so interesting in that role, because you feel like she can sort of summon that sense of being slightly ignored and not being like the most classically beautiful actress of her generation and being sort of sidelined, that it makes sense.
While also, like, time and time again proving what a talent she is.
Yes. So what is it with you and Glenn Close?
She just always seems to play characters that I love. Do you know what I mean? She was Cruella de Vil, for Christ's sake, you know?
The only Cruella, as far as I'm concerned. The fact that Emma Stone is dusting those boots is absolutely a nightmare to me.
But yeah, she just seems to play people that are just the most fascinating, deep, layered characters. I mean, Alex in Fatal Attraction is just... she should have got the Oscar for that one. And then obviously Dangerous Liaisons as well, with the best emotional breakdown scene in a film.
I feel like you're going to do it for us now, are you?
Oh, I can't. It's just screaming, isn't it? She just smashes things. It's just, she always does the thing where she, like, shakes her head when she's furious. She's got a technique for being furious, and she always plays furious people. It's just, I don't know, the characters she plays, I love them. And I've met her, and she's really nice as well. And also there's a similarity in our faces. Not just me in drag, but out of drag as well. We've got very similar features. And I met her and she said the same thing.
Oh, I love that. And I love also that now that she's filming Sunset Boulevard, the musical, that the job opportunities that are just going to fly open for you now.
Do you know what? I would be a liar if I said that I didn't have that in my mind. Because I was like, I know it's going to happen. That's going to come out, and I cannot wait to be tagged in absolutely everything.
I really hope that you get to do sort of like a sell out a little stage show of it kind of thing, like something you can do in like the glory, you know, like a night of Sunset Boulevard that I will definitely come to.
Night of a thousand Normas.
Oh my God. No, and the thing is, everyone would love it because it's really easy costume to do. Just find a turban and a feather and you're laughing. I mean, you have to do this, Joe.
Night of a thousand Normans. And the goal is to get invited to the red carpet, I think.
Yes, I feel like, because they often like hire drag queens to do premieres, don't they, in character? So
Sometimes. They did it for Maleficent, I know that.
So we need to talk about the denouement of this film, which is probably one of the most famous closing scenes of any movie. Can you talk us through it?
Well, Joe is dead. The police have been called. The press have attended. Norma Desmond is gone completely fucking mad. And she now thinks that she's preparing to film a scene for Salome. And she's getting herself ready, and the house is filled with press and film crews and the police, reporters, just everyone. And she, you know, they ask her, you know, Max says to her, you know, come downstairs, madam, the cameras are ready. And in order to lure her down, Max pretends to be directing her as she walks down the stairs to this swelling music, dressed as Salome. And as she gets to the bottom and she says, I can't go on with the scene, I'm too happy. I can't say, I say how happy I am to be back in the studio making another picture. And after this one, after Salome, we'll make another picture and another picture and another picture. And it's she just... When you explain it and you go, the woman is being arrested, but she thinks she's filming a scene. It's been a long week and I wish I could remember it word for word for word. But the most famous thing, and I think for some reason, it's often attributed to Marilyn Monroe for some reason. Because if you say to people, you know, the line, you know, I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille. Some people go, oh, that was Marilyn Monroe, wasn't it? I was like, no. No, it was
wow.
not.
Wow. What a God.
I don't know why people think that. Because it feels like, I think people hear it as, I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille. And it's saucy.
Yes.
But it's not. It's a moment of pure madness.
You're so right. I haven't heard the Marilyn Monroe thing, but definitely that line has been recontextualized as being this sort of like happy birthday, Mr. President, kind of saucy, I'm ready for my close-up. It's rarely contextualized as this moment of pure madness.
And then she's just, you know, I'm ready for my close-up, and it fades, and that's the end of the film.
But you know, that's the most famous line of the movie, undoubtedly. But for me, the part that gives me real shudders is the line that comes directly before that, which is, you know, this is my life. It always has been. And she's, you know, talking and she goes, and you wonderful people out there in the dark. And she sort of reaches to the camera. And it's so frightening, but it's also this moment of like, this is in a movie that's completely about how fame destroys people, how it gives them these crazy expectations of what their life should be, of who they are. It completely inflates and then destroys the sense of self. And we blame the studios and we blame the machine, but also we as the audience are complicit in this fame monster that continues to ruin people's lives, you know? And
when she looks us dead in the eye. We are referenced.
We're part of it. We're part of the whole thing. And maybe that's part of why, you know, when you know, big movie people saw this movie and they were so angry, that was the thing that made them uncomfortable, that it wasn't just them being blamed, but the entire audience that they had fostered and grown, you know?
And all in one 30-second moment, it wraps it all up and says, you know, it says that, you know, it's that last little horrifying, like, wink.
I think we both read this article that was on The Guardian recently for the 70th anniversary of this movie. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was obviously the way every culture article is now written in the context of after the pandemic, aren't we all feeling a bit something something? But this one was saying that, you know, we're kind of all Norma Desmonds now because we're all these sort of shut-ins who rely on a diet of false information that we use to inflate our own senses of self.
If we're not Norma Desmond now, we'll all be Norma Desmond eventually. I don't understand how everyone in the world has not seen this film. I think it should be required viewing. I think it should be required viewing for anyone in entertainment.
I agree.
You know, for my own selfish reasons. Of just that, it's just... And no matter how many times I've seen it, every time I go, oh, it is good, isn't it?
I love showing it to people. I feel like every new dear friend I make has to watch it with me.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've got it on... I've got it on DVD. And then I bought it on Amazon Prime as well. So that, and I have it downloaded to my iPad. So that whenever I want, I can just pop it on no matter where I am. I was like, this film is always for me.
It's always for me. It's so, I think that the people who like it, they really obsess over it. It's such an obsessible film because it's so quotable and because every scene has something mental going on in it, whether like visually or even the music that underscores it is so ghoulish all the time. And this thing as well of I have Gloria Swanson's memoir or somewhere around here.
The Swanson on Swanson.
Swanson on Swanson. It's huge. Do you have it?
Yeah, I've got it. It's lovely red and gold book.
It's the biggest book I own, I think. It's the biggest memoir I own. It's like 900 pages long. She does not skimp on detail. But she does talk about the immediate aftermath of making this movie where her and Betty Davis were the favorites for the 1951 Oscars. And Betty Davis was up for All About Eve, which is, you know, coincidentally, this other movie that's so much about women and aging in Hollywood and what fame does to a person's mind. So clearly there was something going on in the culture that was really reflecting on this. And she ended up losing to Judy Holliday. And, you know, Gloria Swanson's version of events is very much like, look, you know, I've been nominated before, I've lost before, I didn't expect to win, I felt fine, you know, I brought my mum with me to the Oscars, we had a nice night. But then she talks about how everybody who approached her expected her to freak out and expected her to completely just... you know, be like in the last 15 seconds of that movie. And then she realized in that moment, she was like, oh, I've created something that's going to follow me around forever. They really do mm-hmm. think I am this person.
There's a lovely, just in terms of that Oscars, there's a, have you seen Feud?
I have, yeah.
There's a lovely moment when Betty Davis and Joan Crawford are having an argument. And then I think, Betty Davis says something like, you know, and Judy Holliday shouldn't have won the Oscar. That was my year. And they're having the argument. And as Joan Crawford is about to slam a door, and she says something like, and it was Gloria fucking Swanson who should have won the Oscar, you bitch. And then slams the door. It's like she's like basically the last thing before she slams the door is then Gloria Swanson should have won, not you.
And I agree.
I mean, All About Eve is lovely, but you know, Sunset Boulevard holds up better for me.
Yeah, All About Eve is lovely, and the writing is so good. But like, it's kind of like, oh yeah, it's a relationship movie, and it's not. Like Betty Davis's camp, but the movie isn't camp, you know. But I just don't know another film that masters the gothic so well. And gothic is such a Victorian trope, but then it melded on to this very contemporaneous issue of movie stars and Hollywood and what do we do with the aging idols. It's just, there's nothing that looks or feels the same as Sunset Boulevard.
No, I mean, and I think that was down to sort of Billy Wilder's kind of Weimar background. You know, it was.
Yeah, yeah, like Cabinet of Dr. Caligari or something.
Well, I think they didn't. I think they put magnesium in the air when shooting it, so that everything had that kind of dirty look. Everything was dirty, like nothing was clean. I think they put dust on things. There was magnesium in the air. It was meant to look like an old. It was meant to be filmed like those things as well. Just it has sound.
Every time I watch it, like I you live in Brighton, right?
Yeah.
I'm in London, but I feel so lucky that there are so many. I mean, I say so many, maybe one a month silent movie nights that you can go to in London, and you can see these things the way they were meant to be seen. And you do get to see that sort of grimy, graininess of silent movie that's still so charming. And you have that sense when you're watching a silent movie as well, because there isn't dialogue, everybody reacts to the same things at the same time. There's that everyone reacts to the big physical gags and the little facial expressions. And it really captures the room in a way that movies with dialogue just don't. Have you ever found that?
I mean, I'm the only silent movies I've seen in groups of people rather than at home was I saw Nosferatu with a harpist. And that was incredible because you see people jumping to the like moments with the harpist. It was very reactionary. But Nosferatu was definitely like you get big reactions from the audience because the harpist was like directly. I don't know. I felt like we were being conducted.
Yes, that's exactly how it feels like, that you are being conducted. And like you kind of forget as well that because most silent movies, unless they've been preserved and collected by archives or private collectors, they're lost to time, or because the celluloid was so highly flammable, a lot of them have just perished in fires. And there's so many people whose careers that we just don't get to see anymore. And so when you get a chance to see a restored picture that also somebody, and generally whoever is accompanying it musically has had to write that score again. So it's like this incredible creative process that happens when people show silent movies. I find it so fascinating.
Do you know what? Hopefully when the new Sunset Boulevard film comes out, that there becomes Sunset Boulevard viewing parties. I'm going to contact... I'm going to make this statement now. The Duke of York Cinema in Brighton, which I think is Britain's oldest cinema, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's where I saw Nosferatu. Duke of York Picture House. I'm going to contact them and I'm going to say, hey, you, let's do Sunset Boulevard and I'll host it.
Oh, that would be so good. I would so make the journey from London for that.
You know what? Yeah, I've decided. That's my next project.
Okay, Joe, we're probably running out of time. I've kept you over time, actually. Is there anything you'd like to promote at the moment, that any shows that people want to see or anything like that?
Oh, I'm touring the UK in September for my show Decopunk. And all the dates are on MrJoeBlack.com. That's MISTER, not MR. MrJoeBlack.com. Yeah, but just general on my socials, which are all Mr. Joe Black. Hopefully see people on tour in September.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on today, Joe. This has been really fun.
My absolute pleasure.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's CZAROLINE, or email me about the podcast at sentimentalpod@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast. Thank you to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the artwork, and Hannah Varro for the mixing.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.